Kamala Harris chooses her running mate.
Waltz is the governor of Minnesota and a former member of Congress. Prior to his political career, he was a teacher and spent a year in classrooms in China.
Plus, the threat posed by Iran.
The Israelis have to devote their air defenses across the country and kind of spread everything out in order to cover all of these targets.
And later, the latest from Bangladesh, Turkey's precarious diplomatic position, and an update from Kyiv. Today is Tuesday, August 6th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We're off to the Middle East momentarily, but first, some breaking news from Washington. Current Vice President and Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris has chosen Minnesota Governor Tim Walz to be her running mate. VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman has more.
Vice President Kamala Harris said Tuesday that she has chosen Tim Walz as her running mate. Walz is the governor of Minnesota and a former member of Congress. Prior to his political career, he was a teacher and spent a year in classrooms in China. In a statement to supporters, Harris said Walz, who is 60, is a battle-tested leader who has an incredible track record of getting things done for Minnesota families. Harris chose Walz over Josh Shapiro, the more moderate governor of the swing state of Pennsylvania, and several other politicians who were under consideration. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump called Walz an incompetent liberal who will get along just great with Harris because, in his words, they're both far-left radicals that don't know how to govern. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
One of the other top stories we're following for you is, of course, the war in Gaza and the increasing tension in the Middle East. As Israel braces for possible attacks by Iran and Hezbollah, families of Israeli hostages still held in Gaza marked 300 days last week since the war began, with marches and gatherings and with warnings that time is running out. In Gaza, the death toll approaches 40,000 and health officials warn of a growing health crisis as hepatitis cases surge past 100,000. VOA's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Thousands of people marched through the streets of Jerusalem wearing labels with the number 300 on them. The march was organized by Rachel and John Goldberg Polin, whose 23-year-old son Hirsch was among those kidnapped from the Nova Music Festival October 7th. They have worked tirelessly for his release.
Today is day 27. Hirsch is still not home. Today is day 30. Today is day 58. Day 300.
Racheli Frankel, whose 16-year-old son Naftali was kidnapped and killed by Hamas, explains why she and others are marching.
To be together, to express the fact that we're never forgetting. We go to sleep with this at night, we wake up with this in the morning.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he is working to bring the hostages home. But hostage families, and more recently some in his military establishment, have accused him of acting slowly and adding new conditions for a deal with Hamas on a gradual ceasefire that would free the hostages. Netanyahu says that Israel will strike wherever it needs to, including in Yemen and in Beirut. But he says Israel will reach out in peace to those who want peace. In Gaza, the death toll is rising, with the Hamas-run health ministry saying nearly 40,000 Palestinians have been killed in close to 10 months of fighting. Palestinian officials warn of a growing health crisis and are calling on the world to intervene. Dr. Majid Abu Ramadan is the Palestinian health minister in the West Bank. He says disease in Gaza is spreading and there are more than 100,000 cases of hepatitis. Palestinian officials say hospitals have stopped functioning and are in urgent need of equipment. Khalil al-Dakran is the spokesperson for the health ministry in Gaza. He says there is an urgent need for beds, medicine, and medical supplies. More than 90% of Gaza's 2 million people have been displaced at least once and are spending the sweltering heat of the summer in tents with no air conditioning and few sanitation facilities. The fighting is showing no signs of letting up, and people on both sides see no hope for an end anytime soon. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
In a related story, Iran's armed forces have published a list of Israeli civilian and military targets they could strike in retaliation for last week's assassination of the Hamas leader in Tehran. Israel has neither confirmed nor denied responsibility for the killing of Hamas political chief Ismail Haniyeh, but it has warned of a harsh response to any attack on its territory by Iran or its proxies. Brian Carter is a Middle East researcher and portfolio manager at the American Enterprise Institute's Critical Threats Project. My colleague Michael Lippin asked him whether Iran's threat to attack a variety of Israeli targets is more psychological than credible.
So I think it's almost certain that Iran will retaliate. That said, the way that they're messaging, say, lists of targets tells me that they're trying to also achieve a psychological effect, like you say. So we know that they aren't trying to trigger a wider war, yet in their list of targets, there are areas like the Israeli Defense Ministry and the Prime Minister's Office and the Knesset. And hitting all of these locations really risks triggering a wider war. But now that Iran has published a list of targets, the Israelis do need to assign air defense resources to protect these targets, and they will continue to do so. The targets across the whole of the country, because it wasn't just these governmental buildings, but it was also civilian infrastructure, military infrastructure, and so forth, means that the Israelis have to devote their air defenses across the country and kind of spread everything out in order to cover all of these targets. Of course, there's also the added, you know, psychological component for the civilian population, you know, increasing anxiety about the form that this retaliation will take, because I think many expect it will be more significant than the April 13th attack, given that Iran has probably learned lessons since April 13th about these kinds of strikes.
What are the prospects that Israel, instead of just waiting for Iran to make the first move, might preempt an Iranian retaliation by striking out on its own against Iran?
Well, I don't want to get too far into what the Israelis could do. I will say that Israel, like, you know, us at CTP and ISW, I am sure has seen the indications of Iranian-backed militias, particularly in Syria and Iraq, moving assets to prepare for this retaliation. And in that respect, a preemptive strike would be not only warranted, but also just, because the Israelis can see these groups preparing for an attack on Israeli territory and therefore can strike those targets in order to prevent those attacks, or preempt those attacks, rather.
How much time do you think it takes for Israel to see Iranian forces or Iran-backed proxies preparing to launch some kind of strike, and actually for Israel to be able to perhaps take out a unit that is in the process of launching an attack?
So I'm not sure the exact timeline, but I will say we've already seen indications of groups preparing for a retaliation. We've seen media reports of weapon shipments from Iraq into Syria to prepare for attacks towards Israel. We also had a very interesting data point, I think, shows the kind of quick response that Israel can bring within the West Bank, for example. So Shin Bet, one of the Israeli internal security services, saw the indications that Hamas and Iran were preparing for an infiltration attack out of the West Bank into Israel, like an October 7 style attack. And Shin Bet and the IDF collaborated to conduct a series of airstrikes to preempt this attack. And in fact, the IDF also was able to deploy an infantry battalion and other IDF assets to protect that border zone. So you can see how quickly the IDF can respond to some of these contingencies within the West Bank, but also, you know, they will likely strike some areas in Syria in the coming days.
So we've also seen the U.S. moving military assets toward the region, naval assets, Air Force assets. What are the chances that we could see the U.S. deploy some of these capabilities in this escalating situation?
The United States will almost certainly assist in the defense of Israel, just as it did on April 13th. I expect that other U.S. allies in the region, to include Jordan and Saudi Arabia, will also defend as part of the air defense coalition here to protect against the Iranian attack. That said, some of the assets that the United States will need to bring into theater are still several days away from arriving. This includes the Lincoln Carrier Strike Group, which has a number of naval aircraft that fly off the USS Abraham Lincoln, a Nimitz-class carrier. And so Iran knows this. And so there is a kind of opening, a window of opportunity for Iran to conduct this strike while the United States is still bringing its assets into theater.
That's VOA's Michael Lippin speaking with Brian Carter, an analyst for the Critical Threats Project at the American Enterprise Institute. Elsewhere in the Middle East, several American troops were injured in an attack against a military base in Iraq on Monday. This according to three U.S. officials speaking on the condition of anonymity. They said the suspected rocket attack took place at the El Asad Air Base in Iraq, though they also said they were citing initial information that could change and that a full assessment is underway. As tensions rise throughout the region, but especially between Israel and Iran, there are warnings that threats by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to intervene in Gaza could make things worse. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Tens of thousands protested across Turkey Saturday against Israel's war on Hamas. The protests were the latest sign of growing tensions in Turkey over the war in Gaza, which some observers say have been fanned by remarks by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan only a few days earlier. We need to be very strong so that Israel cannot do these outrageous things to Palestine, Erdogan said, adding that just as we entered Karabakh, just as we entered Libya, we can do something similar in Israel. There is no reason for us not to. Turkish flags flew at half-mast as Turkey marked a national day of mourning for the assassinated Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh. But Israeli analysts say Erdogan's military threats take the raging war of words to a new level. Galia Lindenstrauss is with the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv.
Once you use words of military threats, I think this is something you cannot ignore. Yes, many analysts say this will not happen tomorrow. But once you throw these things to the air, those who are in charge of the military have to prepare. And once you have preparations and you have plans, then of course you have to justify them in the future. And then you have to say the other side is threatening. And it has this sort of a circle of enmity that I think is dangerous.
But some say Erdogan's escalating rhetoric is more about the Turkish leader's bid to shore up his nationalist conservative voting base, and his anger at being upstaged by countries like Qatar and Egypt in efforts to resolve the Middle East war. China recently hosted Palestinian leaders, dealing another blow to Erdogan's efforts to appear as a key player in the diplomatic process. The Turkish president publicly vented his frustration, demanding that the Palestinian Authority leader, Mahmoud Abbas, apologize for refusing to accept an invitation to address the Turkish parliament. With Ankara enforcing a trade embargo against Israel and the war of words escalating, analysts warn the countries are now on an even more dangerous course. Galia Lindenstrauss is an analyst with the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv.
There's nothing left anymore to stop
As the conflict expands to Lebanon and possibly Iran,
and
analysts warn Erdogan may find yet more opportunities to raise his rhetoric against Israel and further widen the conflict. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Ukraine came under heavy attack Monday night. We'll get an update in a few moments. First, though, the latest from Bangladesh following Monday's resignation of Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina. Leilo Shahroshahi has the story.
Bangladesh's army chief is set to meet student protest leaders on Tuesday as the country awaits a new government. This comes a day after Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina resigned and fled the country following a violent uprising against her rule. The student leaders who spearheaded the protests against job quotas and called for Hasina's resignation are seeking an interim government with Nobel Peace Laureate Mohamed Yunus as its chief advisor. Three organisers of the student movement released a Facebook video early on Tuesday outlining what they want. Naheed Islam is one of the movement's key leaders.
We will not accept any other government other than the one proposed by us. We will not accept the government supported by the military or the fascists. Any proxy government or government against the people will not be accepted.
He also claimed that Yunus has agreed to be the advisor of the interim government. 84-year-old Yunus and his Grameen Bank won the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize for work in alleviating poverty by granting tiny loans of under $100 to the rural poor in Bangladesh. He was indicted by a court in June on charges of embezzlement, which he denies. Yunus did not immediately respond to a request for comment.
That's Reuters' Leila Shahroshahi reporting for us today. And for more on the situation in Bangladesh and what it means for the region, I'm joined by Farwa Amer. She's Director of South Asia Initiatives at the Asia Society Policy Institute.
Period of political instability was lingering even before elections that happened in January. The elections themselves didn't help the unrest, and public dissatisfaction just grew. And there's so much controversy around it not being free and fair. When these circumstances emerged in the past few weeks and intensified, they kind of just further added to the fragility of the governance that we've been seeing and witnessing in Bangladesh over the past few months. And it was sort of like the final nail in the coffin, so to speak, you know, making it harder and harder for Sheikh Hasina to retain control and power. At this time, it felt like it was almost unattainable. So against that backdrop, the news of her resignation and eventually leaving Bangladesh, this was not all too surprising. Rapid, indeed, but not shocking.
The student protesters, they want Mohamed Yunus to lead the interim government. Nobel Prize winning, I think he's an economist, not a government professional. Do you think that is a viable idea?
For what it's worth, as we see, and we're talking about stability, and we're talking about rebuilding the nation, and kind of making sure that order, law and order can be maintained, which is currently a challenge, as we are seeing from the visuals that are coming through or the reports that are coming through. So it has to be through a dialogue with the civilians. It has to be through a dialogue with the students, whether it's military or the president now. So if Mohamed Yunus is an individual that they propose, then he, you know, has to be given due consideration in order to make sure that peace and trust can be restored.
Sheikh Hasina had been in power so long. Many of the levers of power, the institutions of government in Bangladesh, were loyal to her. How hard will it be for a new government, a new, not just an administration, but really a whole new apparatus to come in and start governing effectively?
That is where the uncertainty really lies. You know, Sheikh Hasina being in power, holding a tight hold on the media as well. Opposition was not very powerful during her time, as you rightly pointed out. Institutions were also quite government-led. So when this entire period of transition, as we foresee, and the developments happen, I think that's one thing that is of a concern, that how do you make sure that all the underlying causes of the unrest that were even pre-July protests, all the way, you know, starting from the elections and onwards, including economic disparities, political freedoms, and the governance issues that were inherent to Sheikh Hasina's government, how can those be addressed? And then in order to make sure that, you know, there is a future Bangladesh that this youth population really looks up to and want to be a part of, It should emphasize reconciliation. It should emphasize democratic reforms and robust economic strategies to fairly rebuild and strengthen the nation. And that's where the key would be for any for the interim government, but mainly for when the new government takes power.
Farwa Amer is the director of South Asia Initiatives at the Asia Society Policy Institute. Ms. Amer, thanks very much for your time. Thanks for your analysis today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Russia launched a barrage of drones and missiles at Ukraine overnight, while authorities in southwestern Russia say that troops are crossing into Kursk. Correspondent Anna Chernikova has the latest from Kyiv.
Late Monday evening and into the early hours of Tuesday, Russian forces launched a ballistic missile and drone attack across Ukraine. At 11 p.m. local time, a series of explosions were heard in Kyiv. According to official information, the Russian forces attacked the capital of Ukraine with ballistic missiles and drones. According to the local authorities, the explosions that were heard were caused by the work of air defense. Due to the falling rocket debris, damages to a parking lot in one of the districts of the capital were reported, as well as damage to a couple of residential buildings and a gas station elsewhere in the Kyiv region. No casualties were reported. Russian forces also shelled a residential neighborhood in central Kharkiv. According to preliminary information, Russian forces attacked around 10 a.m. local time on August 6 with an Iskander ballistic missile. As a result of the attack, residential buildings and a hospital were damaged. 8 people were injured, including an 8-month-old baby. Kharkiv authorities report that more people may remain under the rubble. The rescue operation is ongoing. The Ukrainian military says that Russian subversive intelligence groups entered the outskirts of Toretsk in the Donetsk region twice in the last 3 days. The city remains under the control of the Ukrainian armed forces, but the Russian forces are moving towards the city quickly. Meanwhile, the local authorities of the Kursk region in Russia reported attempts to break through the border into Russia from the territory of Ukraine. According to the acting governor of the Kursk region, the armed forces of Ukraine are behind this. Also, on Tuesday morning, the Kursk region authorities reported the downing of 14 drones. Local telegram channels reported about a series of explosions heard in 6 Russian districts. Previously, in March, the so-called Russian Volunteer Corps and other volunteer formations allegedly composed of Russian citizens and fighting on the side of Ukraine announced an assault on the Belgorod and Kursk regions. Voluntary formations also did not comment on information about new attempts to break through the border of the Russian Federation. The General Staff of the Armed Forces of Ukraine did not comment on these reports. VOA cannot verify this information independently. Anna Chernikova, VOA News.
Following up on a story we brought you on Monday's show, the UN Security Council met Tuesday in New York to discuss the famine situation in Sudan. Ada Mosornu is the Director of Operations and Advocacy for the Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
Our worst fears were confirmed last week. The Famine Review Committee concluded that famine conditions are present in Zamzam Camp, close to El-Fasher, the capital of North Darfur. This is the same camp that Médecins Sans Frontières warned about 6 months ago, where one child was dying every 2 hours from malnutrition. The Famine Review Committee also found the famine conditions are also likely present in other displacement camps and in and around the city. This announcement should stop all of us cold, because when famine happens, it means we are too late.
The UN is calling for unimpeded humanitarian access to stop a large-scale famine from taking hold. And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.